The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And you're listening to Where Did the Road Go? And tonight on the show, author of a book entitled The Other Side of Truth, we have Paul Kimball. Can you hear us, Paul?
Yes, I can. Hi, everybody. Good to be talking to you on Where Did the Road Go? From Ithaca, New York, right?
Yes, and you're in Nova Scotia?
Halifax, Nova Scotia. Yeah, that's right. So we're not too far away.
No, but you're a couple time zones away, aren't you?
Just one. So just one. If it's okay. 11 o'clock there, it just turned midnight here.
Okay, all right. And you're kind of all over the place with the paranormal. You don't focus on one particular thing. And you also direct movies. You've been a musician, so you're kind of a jack of all trades with this stuff.
Yeah, in a roundabout way, I guess. I mean, my music, it might have been paranormal. I don't know. You'd have to ask the audience members. But I was just a rock pop musician in the 90s after I gave up my law career. So the paranormal stuff, yeah, I started making films. I got into the film industry in the late 90s. After the music career, I decided I wasn't going to be the next Paul McCartney. So I thought, well, maybe I can become the next Orson Welles. So started making films, including documentaries. I've done a lot of docs about things that don't have anything to do with the paranormal. But I have made a few about the paranormal, starting with a biography of UFO researcher Stan Friedman back in 2001 for television up here in Canada.
And you're related to him, aren't you?
Yes, he's my uncle. He married my dad's sister 35 or so years ago, I guess now. So yeah, I've known Stan since I was a little kid, or at least a young teenager. And people always ask me, they say, well, is that why you got interested in the UFO phenomenon? And I go, well, you know, I don't really know why I got interested in it. I'm sure Stan had some impact, but the truth, because I would talk to him, he was a fascinating guy when I was a kid. But the truth is, I wasn't terribly interested in it until I started making the film about him. You know, I was aware of it. I'd seen a couple of his lectures when I was younger. My dad had a couple of books, as I think everyone did in the 70s, the sort of the Eric Von Däniken books and those kinds of things. But really, you know, my undergraduate degrees were in history and political science. I went to law school. I was playing in the music industry after that. I wasn't interested really at all in the paranormal any more than anybody else would be. It was when I started making the film on Stan, and then some follow-up films, I immersed myself in the UFO subculture as part of the research. I wanted to get to know, obviously, who these people were that I was going to be meeting and interviewing. Wanted to familiarize myself more with the subject matter, and that's when I started to find it interesting. So in a roundabout way, Stan did get me into the whole paranormal thing, but not for the reasons that I think people think, in the sense that he inculcated me as a young man and groomed me to be his successor or something. No, it's just I was doing a film on him and a biography, really, and I wanted to make sure that I had my research tight. And once I started doing that, I found this. I like mysteries. I've always liked mysteries. And there's a large element of history to the UFO phenomenon, too, when you go back and study it. And that appealed to me from one of my earlier incarnations as a young historian. So yeah, you know, a whole bunch of factors, but it hasn't just been UFOs either. Since then, I've done a television series on ghost investigating. I always put ghosts in quotation marks, but popularly that phenomenon is known as ghosts.
Right.
And some other stuff too. So, you know, and my range of acquaintances has broadened as well. Friends like Nick Redfern and Greg Bishop, the late Mac Tonys, people of similar mind and interest. All of us have a rather eclectic view of the paranormal in general. So we don't just focus on UFOs or ghosts or remote viewing or whatever. We're interested in all of it. And that's something that perhaps differentiates me from Stan, because he's spent his entire career focused on just the UFO phenomenon.
And you're more of a skeptic as well coming into this, not a debunker, but a skeptic.
Yeah, I still am. I mean, everybody, I think, should be a skeptic.
I agree.
Because I think the fundamental takeaway from the... It's sort of the motto that I kind of... I'm good at coming up with mottos. The journey is the destination, or and, you know, other things. But the one I sort of came up with first that people actually still kind of quote me on is don't believe, don't disbelieve, think. And I think that's the motto of skepticism. So you shouldn't... It's what my friend Greg Bishop calls the excluded middle. There's people on one side who are arch believers. They will say, this is it. This is what it has to be. I will accept no other answer. I'm convinced. Well, okay, I can't really have a conversation with those folks because we're not talking sort of about the same thing, or at least in the same way. On the other hand, there are people on the exact opposite side, the yin to the yang, if you will, who say there can't be anything to this. We live in a purely materialistic world. There is nothing whatsoever to the paranormal. This is it. You're born, you live, you die, and that's it. There's nothing. Well, I can't have a conversation with them either. Skeptics are the people that sort of sit in the middle. And I prefer the term, I actually have come to prefer the term agnostic, which sort of harkens to a more religious or spiritual thing. But I think that's actually kind of where we are when we're dealing with the paranormal, or conversely where we are when we're dealing with religion. So yeah, I kind of call myself a hopeful agnostic. I hope it's true. I've had interesting experiences that I can't explain. I know plenty of people I trust and believe who recount similar interesting experiences and different ones too that they can't explain. So it comes down to the can't explain part. That's what keeps me as an agnostic. I guess I've drifted towards the believer camp though over the years, in the sense that I do believe, although the lawyer in me says I accept on the balance of probabilities, it's more likely than not that we are dealing with some form of advanced non-human intelligence that is interacting with us in very strange ways and has been since really the beginning of human history, and for all I know was interacting with us even before that. But certainly if you look back through human history and the work of people like Jacques Vallée, I mean, everyone trots out Jacques Vallée's name, and that's the go-to guy when you talk about somebody who looks beyond just 1947 and UFOs, or says UFOs might actually be related to ghosts, which might actually be related to, you know, this phenomenon, cryptozoology, this phenomenon over here. It might all be interrelated. But there's a lot of other people that have written the same kinds of things. John Keel, although some of Keel's work was problematic. My friend Nick Redfern. I mean, the guys I hang out with, Nick, Greg, Mac Tonies, before he passed away. So that idea that it might all be interrelated, that the one thing that we're reasonably certain of is there is non-human intelligence interacting with us, whether you call it God or aliens from Zeta Reticuli or whatever answer you want to put on it. Most of us that have fallen to that camp really don't care and don't think it's terribly important, and also don't think we can know what it is or where it's from. The more important, or the more interesting too, I would say, question is, what is it doing and why is it doing? And can we discern some sort of pattern of behavior out of it that might give us an answer as to why it's behaving, why it's interacting with us in the way that it does?
All right. Well, I think the term skeptic has kind of been hijacked, where it initially meant someone who questions. Now it seems to be associated with someone who disbelieves, which falls more into the debunker definition, really.
Right. And, you know, I'm a happy debunker, too. If it's bunk, it should be debunked.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite debunkers is Stan Friedman. Stan Friedman has happily gone about debunking within the UFO subculture people who have come forward, whether it's Bob Lazar or Philip Corso, who are lying, who are spreading, you know, false information.
Right.
And so he debunks them. So Stan Friedman is one of the great debunkers of the last 40 years, even as he is also a believer in his particular narrative, the things that he believes in. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with debunking it if you can show that it's bunk too, because there's an awful lot of people out there that are, you know, not just in the paranormal, anywhere, that are spreading bunk, and there always has been. So those are the kind of people who should be called out. You should say, look, these people are not telling you the truth. They're just trying to sell you something or gain notoriety or whatever. And then go focus on the people that are actually serious about what they're doing and genuine and honest about what they're doing. And so debunkers are good. What you don't want are people like James Randi. I don't like the term debunkers because I think, as I said, some are good. I like the term disbelievers because that indicates their state of mind, which is they are simply not willing to believe, even if they're presented with reasonable evidence that shows that there might actually be something there. They'll ignore it. So they're disbelievers in the same way that a believer, you could present a believer, a true believer, say in the alien meme of UFOs. If you believe in that, I've met them. There's a lot of people that you could literally just say, well, okay, I'm going to tell you this crazy story. And they'll believe it because they have already accepted that that is the truth. The disbelievers like James Randi and his cult are the exact same, only in the opposite way. They will disbelieve anything, even if you start in front of them evidence and stories and witness accounts that indicate that they're from credible people, that indicate that there might actually be something here that's worth taking a look at. They don't want to hear it. They'll just disbelieve. So, you know, as my friend Greg says, in the excluded middle, that's where the rest of us sit. And those two sides can argue amongst themselves. It's kind of like the old Star Trek episode where the guy who has a black face for on one half and a white face on the other, and he's been fighting with this guy who has the colors flipped on his face, and they continue to fight even though their planet's destroyed and all that sort of stuff. To me, that's what the believers and the disbelievers are doing. They just continue to fight, and it's this never-ending circle, and I'm not interested in it. So, you know, the rest of us, we just move on, and we have a conversation. So they yell at each other. Those of us in the excluded middle, we actually talk, and I think that's far more productive.
All right. What problems do you see with Keel's work?
That's a very long conversation. besides the fact that I don't think he was a terribly good writer, he had some interesting ideas. And besides the fact that almost anyone who knew him said he was a really cranky person who was very difficult to deal with. In Keel's case, Keel was a good relator of stories.
Yes.
But he also, a large number of people that I know think that he was also a very good creator of stories. That not everything that he was relating, he wasn't just relating everything. In some cases, he was actually creating stuff. And so then you have to say, well, okay, which of the things about Keel that he's talking about are real, and which are the ones that he actually maybe made up?
Right.
And that, you know, you can't say that about Jacques Vallée, for instance.
No,
Jacques Vallée, very serious. I know you can't say that about my friend Nick Redfern. Nick is not creating stuff, he's just relating stuff. And I'm the same way. But Keel had that reputation of maybe being nonfiction some of the time and fiction some of the other time.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Yeah.
I've also
that makes him a little less reliable, but that doesn't mean that everything he was writing, I mean, he wrote an awful lot. That doesn't mean that everything he was writing is without worth or merit. It just means you have to look at it a little more carefully and try and sift it.
Yeah.
But my fundamental problem with Keel is I've just never found his writing very good or interesting.
I've always enjoyed his stuff.
Yeah, I mean, to each their own. Most of my friends, like Greg and Nick and Mac, really liked Keel, or still do. I just never got into him. So it's a matter of taste as much as anything else.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, because he did write in a very easy-to-read, almost storytelling manner rather than relaying facts one after the other.
Yeah, I actually prefer that sort of style. I just didn't think he was very good at it. But that's just me.
Right. I know
a lot of people, and yourself included, would disagree with my assessment. I mean, I don't think he's the worst writer I've ever read. And, you know, there's some of his stuff I have enjoyed and I find interesting. But I'm just not as big a fan of Keel as I am, or as some of my friends are.
Right. Okay. Well, you did, now, what was the name of the ghost show you did? Ghost in quotation marks, of course.
It was a series called Ghost Cases. It ran for one season up here in Canada on television, and it's currently airing. I like to say it's currently airing in the axis of evil and irrelevant countries around the world. So I shouldn't say that in case they're listening, but it's airing in Iran, Thailand, which is not an irrelevant country, and Albania, of all places. So our distributor has sold it into... I'm sure my co-host Holly and I will be very popular in Tehran, Albania.
That's just that's bizarre.
It is. It's like, I get Thailand because the Asian market is always picking up stuff from here, sometimes even if they don't really care. It boggles my mind that Iran took it.
Yeah.
There's a station in Iran apparently broadcasting it. And Albania, of all the... I mean, Eastern Europe has a very rich and old folklore history. So that doesn't bother me or weird me out quite so much. It's just Albania is not a country that rolls off your tongue in casual conversation in North America. It's like, oh, I wonder what's going on in Albania today. So... The weird thing is I've always been fascinated by Albania, going back to the Albanian monarchy, sort of in quotation marks, in the 1920s, and King Zog, just because anybody named King Zog is, I mean, that, how can you not be amused by that?
Right.
So I actually know quite a bit about Albanian history and culture. So when I was told by the distributor that Ghost Cases was going to be airing in Albania, I said, well, see if you can work a promotional tour, because I'd love to go to Albania, and I could actually converse with them, I think, probably more intelligently than any North American television host about their history and their culture.
Nice.
But so far it hasn't worked out that way. So,
all right. Now, when you went into this ghost stories thing, what was your opinion on ghosts before you did it?
Open-minded skepticism, I guess. I still don't. In fact, having done it, I definitely don't. I don't believe that it's the spirits of, you know, your dearly departed grandmother or her dog or Julius Caesar, or, you know, dead people.
Right.
That never made sense to me. In fact, I've always thought that that is probably the least imaginative way you could think about the afterlife, is that you'd be condemned to return or choose to return to wander this one hallway in a hotel, for instance, and haunt guests or right. something like that. That I never bought that, and I still don't. I think that's us projecting onto the phenomenon what we maybe would like to believe, which is, oh, you know, we go away, but we can come back and interact with each other. And that's fine. You know, I don't want to ruin anybody's belief that they've actually had an experience with their great uncle or something. That's just not what I see, and it doesn't make any sense to me.
Well,
sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, but I do believe there is something to the phenomenon. Had numerous experiences myself while being out in the field shooting the host. Freudian slip, sorry. I didn't shoot my host, even though I was tempted to on a couple of occasions. No, she's still alive. Shooting the show with my co-host, Holly Stevens. And the interesting takeaway that I took, it was kind of the thing that skewered my sort of skepticism a little more towards believerism, if you will, at least the belief that we're interacting with something, is going out in the field and experiencing it yourself. You can listen to all the stories from all the people in the world, and you can be impressed by them. You could even believe them. But there's nothing like actually doing it in order to sort of really focus your mind on it. So somebody, for instance, if you've never experienced pain, somebody could describe it to you. You could intellectually process and go, I get it. It's unpleasant. It's not something it sounds like I'd want to experience. But until somebody actually pokes you with a knife or something and you experience pain for the first time, you couldn't really understand what pain is. Well, I kind of think the paranormal is the same way. People can describe it to you until the cows come home. But until you actually go out there and experience it yourself, you know, it's not the same thing. So when we... Going through those 13 episodes, and we only did one season, I'd never sought to find a unified field theory of the paranormal. I'd never really thought about it, actually. I actually always kind of thought that UFOs were separate from ghosts, compartmentalized, which is generally what everybody who's interested, most people are not interested in everything. Like I said, my friends are, the people I hang out with are.
Right.
But most people find their thing, like Stan, and they focus on it. So the weird thing is, I've met a lot of people who are interested in UFOs who think people who are interested in ghosts are crazy.
Yep.
Conversely, I've met a lot of people who are interested in ghosts who think people who are interested in UFOs are crazy.
And that's always amused me.
Yes, me too. Certainly, especially over the last 4 years since I did the ghost series, because I think it's all interrelated, which is kind of what I talk about in the book. I cover ghosts, and I cover shadow people, and I cover UFOs and reincarnation, all sorts of stuff. But to me, the kind of thing I took away from it, once I stopped trying to figure out, well, I never really tried to figure it out, but once I really said, I don't care where this is from, I'm more interested in what it's about. So I changed the perspective. Instead of arguing about whether they're aliens from Zeta Reticuli or your dead grandmother, grandmother, whatever, I said, what's the common pattern here? Does this resemble anything that I'm familiar with in my own existence? And to me, it did. All aspects of the paranormal in different ways, and I talk about this in the book, resemble what I generally call art, in quotation marks, A-R-T. Now, people have chastised me on, and you know, on internet message boards and stuff, and said, well, what are you saying, that the aliens, which is usually when they lose me, but they continue, you know, are the aliens basically, you know, trying to, a Robert Mapplethorpe kind of photograph or something, you know, what are you talking about? I go, you're misunderstanding what I mean by art. Art is not just a painting, and art is not just a pop song. Art is all of it, and so much more. It's a fundamental way of communicating without having to use language, with the possible exception of song lyrics. But even song lyrics, I can listen to German Lieder, for instance, classical music. I don't have to understand what they're saying. I can understand what they're... I don't actually have to understand the language. I can understand what they're saying by the way that the singer is emoting the words, so I can get the general meaning. We have a communication problem, which is, if you're Peruvian and you speak Spanish and I'm Albanian and I speak Albanian, you and I are not going to converse. We might, if we're in the same place or we can see each other's face, then we can, and I think that's a form of art, you know, when you, the way you use your face to communicate, we might be able to understand at least what we're thinking. But if we're talking on Skype, as you and I are now, and we can't actually see each other, if we were speaking different languages, we wouldn't be able to understand each other. Even if we're speaking the same language, we have trouble, you know, there's so much going on in our mind, and then we have to filter it out through this form of verbal communication, which is tremendously limiting. I think we've all at some point gone through an experience where the takeaway would have been, if only I could have said that better or longer or better, especially when you're trying to talk to a girl. That's not what I meant. Come back, kind of thing. Whereas art is a much more subtle and nuanced form of communication that deals with emotions and feelings, very basic things. So that's what I look at the paranormal, and I say all this stuff that is happening, that they're interacting with us, is a form of artistic expression. That's how I look at it. But really a form of communication that resembles art. And they're using the simple and yet complex tools of any artist to try and communicate very simple messages to us. And those simple messages, and you know, they're not, people say, well, wait a second, why aren't they giving us the cure for cancer? That's important to us. Or why aren't they solving the North Korean crisis or whatever? And I go, well, you know, that's important to us, but I don't think that's terribly important in the grand scheme of things. I mean, yes, if you have cancer, the cure for cancer would be very important to you. But in the big picture, it's not.
Right.
Humanity in the big picture isn't terribly important, really, when you think about it. We've only been here a very, very, very short period of time. So if we're dealing with something that's truly advanced, to them, the big picture, I think, would be more about, hey, we just want you guys to think, I hate this phrase, but I'm going to use it anyway, outside the box. We want to stimulate your imagination. We want you to think about possibilities that are beyond sort of the day-to-day lives that you live, which includes the cure for cancer. You know, just the broader picture, time and space and life and death, very existential stuff. That's what I think art at its core stimulates, particularly imagination. And I think they, you know, if I was them, this is how I would imagine they would talk to themselves. And they say, look, we don't want to give these guys the answers, whatever, to all their petty little problems. What we want to do is fire their imagination so they can discover the answers themselves to their petty little problems, but so that they can also discover the answers to much bigger questions. And that would be how they relate to each other, how they interact, where their species is going to go, and all that sort of stuff. And that's what I think at its best artists do better than anyone else. And so that's what I look at when I see the paranormal. And that's what it's the only thing that makes sense to me in terms of trying to understand why an advanced non-human intelligence would be interacting with us. It's the only reason that I can see. So that's the reason that I accept and postulate in the book.
Right, right. Very well, actually. And you start out just kind of giving that general premise, but by the end, the premise is a lot more convincing than the way you start it. You fill it out nicely, and you expand on it throughout in a really good way. The book is the book is very enjoyable. It's an easy read, but it has a lot of information in it. And was any of this stuff originally on your blog?
Some of it was. Actually, I was when I sat down to read the book, write the book, my original intent was just to be lazy and take a whole bunch of postings from my blog and kind of say, here's the best of my Other Side of Truth blog, because I had had this relatively popular blog running for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And then I decided, well, that is actually kind of lazy. And, you know, a lot of the writing on the blog, it's very bloggish in the sense that it doesn't translate. It didn't have a coherent narrative. And I thought, if I'm going to do this, first of all, I'd never really discussed most of the ghosty experiences on the blog and some of the other things that had happened since. I said, you know what, I'd actually like to do this right, which is write a proper book and try and make a point and try and, you know, see if I can start a conversation. So a few things, I think, from the blog got woven into that, in the sense that particularly when in those occasions when I'd be talking about UFOs, I might have pulled one or two passages out of the blog and rearranged them a bit and then put them in the book. But by and large, if somebody was to ask me, you know, how much of it was from your blog and how much of it was new or relatively new, I'd say, I don't know, 6% from the blog and 94% was new. But there's no question that having done the blog for so many years, that certainly inspired me to at least think about writing a book.
Right. Okay. Well, anytime I talk with ghost hunters and stuff, one of my questions for them always is, how do you know it's dead people that you're dealing with? Because I have yet to meet a ghost hunter who doesn't believe they're dealing with spirits of the dead. And now you had experiences that you relate in this book that would convince other people that they were still dealing with spirits of the dead, didn't you?
Right. And you've just met, although I hate the term ghost hunter because I've never actually gone hunting for ghosts. I abhor violence. I hate guns. And so the ghosts are perfectly safe for me. I'm just there to take pictures. So I'm more of a ghost explorer, if you will.
Fair enough.
But yeah, you know, I suppose you could take every single experience that we had, and you could interpret it, I guess, if you wanted to, as the spirits of the dead. Just like with the UFO stories I've heard, people could take them in, they could, if they want to, interpret them as this has to be aliens from Zeta Reticuli.
Right.
I don't know how you could say that with any certainty, though. I have never had, even if I had, let's assume that I had, I was sitting in a room, this didn't happen, folks, but if it did, and an apparition appeared to me, walked over, sat down across from me and said, "Hi, I'm Frank. I was born in 1854, and I died in 1931. I'm back, and I just wanted to say hello." So, you know, that would be like, okay, then I'm dealing with a dead person or a spirit of a dead person. But how do I know I can trust Frank?
Right.
You know, how do I know Frank's telling me the truth? How do I know it's really Frank? And so, I mean, literally, that would be the, even if they came to you and said, "I am this," well, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are. For instance, I make feature films. I'm making one now where there's a character in the film who may or may not be the devil. But let's just say at the end of the film, the character literally turns to the audience, stares out from the screen and goes, "I am the devil." Well, okay, is anyone in the theater actually going to believe that he's really the devil? Because I can... Oh, they're coming. I can guarantee you he's not. He's a very good actor named Jacob James. He lives in Ontario. And he's not the devil. He just plays him on, you know, in a feature film. But that's kind of what, you know, so that's kind of what you're looking at. You're watching a presentation of something, I think, when you're dealing with these ghosts. I'll call them ghosts for easy conversation. You know, that's a presentation. That's something that's happening in front of you. But that doesn't necessarily, the most simplistic interpretation you can take on that is, well, okay, that's clearly is what it's meant to be, right? That's what it looks like. It's got to be that then. Well, that doesn't explain the fact that those kinds of apparitions or experiences or whatever take many, many different forms when you go to these so-called haunted places. So one person could go into a haunted place and experience it one way, and another person, and I've had this happen, I've had it happen literally while we were there. I was experiencing something that was completely different from what Holly was experiencing somewhere else. Well, okay, how do you process that? Because that's not just Frank walking down the hallway. that's a whole bunch of different things happening. So I think when you look at it in its whole, when you look at all of this stuff that has to do with so-called ghosts, it's much more complex. There are a lot of moving parts, and it's not... There you go. I'm the first ghost hunter you've ever met who says, look, there's nothing about it that I see that indicates to me that it's the spirits of the dead returning to talk to us. In fact, everything about it that I see indicates to me that it's not. That what we're dealing with is this advanced non-human intelligence that is presenting us with a show. Mm-hmm. And to get us thinking and talking and imagining. And it worked with me. I mean, I'm the poster child, if that is true. I'm the poster child for success. Because you know, when I was done, they would have said, hey, look at this guy. We need to get him in our commercials for what we're doing, because we turned him from, you know, maybe being this kind of skeptic to a much more open-minded skeptic who's now speculating about these things, and he's moving towards, he's imagining. And he's much more open-minded. That's what we wanted to do. We didn't want to fill in the blanks for him. We didn't want to do his homework for him. But we wanted him to think for himself. And then off I go, and maybe I go off in an entirely different direction than somebody else would go. But that's fine. That's okay. The problem is, I'm not going to tell anyone I'm absolutely right. I have my ideas, my theories. If you like them, great. If you read the book or listen to me on the radio or whatever, and you go, hey, that's interesting, and it inspires you to think, and maybe what you think of is a little like mine, but you go in your own direction, that's cool. Absolutely. That's what it's about. What I don't like are when people say, this is what it has to be. So that, generally speaking, is all these ghost hunters who say, yep, it's the spirits of the dead. So that's what it is. And they show up at somebody's house, and literally the television show Ghost Hunters created this template, at least for modern television, and immediately say, this is absolutely what it's got to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a reason I don't watch Ghost Hunters. I never have, and I never will. I mean, that's intellectually limiting. It's completely unimaginative, and it's really, frankly, quite dull. So, you know, with a phenomenon that is so much more interesting, and that's... Sorry, I'm prattling on, but I'll just say one last thing. UFOs, ghosts, whatever it is, the paranormal in general, and religion too. By the way, I talk about this in the book. I say, what is the ultimate in the paranormal? I mean, because most of us are believers, or at least pay lip service to the paranormal. Anyone who goes to church does. The ultimate in paranormal is God, the concept of an all-powerful supernatural being. In the Christian sense, but every other denomination has its own aspects, but in the Christian sense, who sent his own son, through a virgin birth to the planet Earth, to be killed and then reincarnated and resurrected. I mean, you just look at the entire story and you go, we couldn't dream anything up like that today that would be more paranormal than that. So the idea of, quote, the paranormal runs through, at one point I even say every president of the United States, with maybe one or two exceptions, has publicly been the paranormalist in chief. They swear an oath in the Bible. Mm-hmm. They all, especially the modern ones, and including Obama, who is, I use quotes from Obama, who consistently talks about his own Christian faith. These are people who believe, or at least they say they believe, and I'll take them at their word, in a paranormal being. So it's nothing we should be ashamed about. But all of it gets reduced, and religion does this too, gets reduced to the most banal, structured kind of box that you have to sit in. So that's what organized religion does to me. That's what organized paranormal research does to me, whether it's ghost hunters or ufology or whatever they call it. Those are very interesting things to study as an historian or as a sociologist or as an anthropologist. But if you actually are interested in the wonder and mystery of the paranormal, those are the last places you should be looking. You should be on your own search, finding like-minded people and trying to experience it yourself, and have a much more open mind than listening to a sermon from the Catholic Church or listening to a sermon from a speaker at a UFO conference, because that's what they are, they're sermons, or listening to a sermon from the host of Ghost Hunters, because they're telling you to believe something. And that's not what the paranormal to me is about. What the paranormal is about is trying to tell you to think about something. And there's a difference between those two things.
All right. Well, we'll be back with Paul Kimball in 45 seconds right after this.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And tonight on Where Did the Road Go, we have Paul Kimball, author of The Other Side of Truth. And, I would almost say that in order to understand the paranormal, even to begin to understand it, we have to re-understand what we think reality is. You there, Paul?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Sure. Just didn't want to interrupt.
It just seems like what we think of as reality is too limited to include that aspect. Like, it stands outside of our understanding of reality.
Yeah. Well, you know, our understanding of reality is an the very term reality is an interesting concept. I mean, I'm a big fan of science. I really am. Huge fan of science. So one of my personal heroes is Carl Sagan. Mm-hmm. However, the problem I have with science is, and their notion of reality, and sort of the Western materialist way now of thinking of reality as given to us by institutionalized science. And I'm going to add science to that list of religion and the paranormal and the ufology and everything else. Again, science is a wondrous, magical is the wrong term, wondrous, mysterious, innovative, imaginative thing. Unless it's institutionalized science, which then you're putting it into that box again, and you're stifling imagination and free thought. So there's so much we don't know. I mean, to say there's so much we don't know doesn't even begin to do it justice. The universe is vast. Even if this is the only universe that exists, and many scientists will tell you now that it's probably not the only universe that exists. But even if it was, it's huge. And by saying huge, that's one of those language communication issues. We cannot comprehend how large the universe is. You view the videos and look at the little maps that people do and stuff and go, we are here, and we just can't comprehend it. We can't even comprehend, really. I mean, honestly, I don't think we can comprehend how far it is to the nearest star system, which is, I think, about 4 light years away.
Yeah.
We certainly can't comprehend how far it is to the edge of the galaxy, and you know, there's the millions upon millions of galaxies beyond that. So here we are on our little blue dot, as Carl Sagan would say, with our concepts of what reality is. And there's the universe out there. And again, I'm just assuming there's only one universe for the sake of argument. So I'm reducing it to its lowest possible common denominator. Only one universe, ours is it. There's so much we don't know about that universe and how it works and what might be out there or what might be in here, frankly,
right,
with us, that to say we know what reality is pretty foolish. And so that's one of those things whenever anybody says to me, you know, well, that can't be because we know what reality is, I go, well, I can't, we're not really going to have much of a conversation here because you and I have a different version of what reality is. And it's not that I'm crazy. It's just that I have an understanding that we know virtually nothing about who we are, what we are, and where we are. Whereas a lot of these people, particularly who fall in the disbeliever camp, as I call them, are absolutely convinced that we know who we are, what we are, and where we are. And we're just kind of filling in a few of the details, but yeah, we're almost there. I got news for you. We haven't even put our name on the front page. If it's a test, you know, we haven't even written our name down on the front page of the paper, much less actually started to fill in the questions. So, I mean, we're still at the question asking stage, and we will be long after you and I and everyone else that we know is dead and buried. We'll still be asking questions rather than getting answers. And so that doesn't mean that science... Then I go to the believer side, though, and a lot of people in the New Age movement would say, well, science is useless then, to which I would say, no, science gives us the cure for things like cancer. You know, science is a very useful thing. It's also a very useful, when applied properly, way of thinking of things, sure, of working out problems. But like everything else, it isn't the be-all and end-all of knowledge. And so... Yeah, you're right. It's a little more complicated, which is to say it's a lot more complicated than just saying we know what reality is and there's nothing left to learn. Mm-hmm. And I do actually kind of hear that from people, at least not in those words, but that's what they mean from time to time. And, you know, that's that they're part of the problem, not part of the solution.
Now, what role do you ever see the role of, like, the trickster in when you're doing these investigations, like where it almost feels like something's just playing with you?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I don't like the term the trickster because I think it's a little too clever by half, but I understand where they're coming from. I think it's an element. It's like if I was to take people, I talk about this art thing. So here's a room. I have a room full of people. There's five people in the room. One of them is a musician. One of them's I'm just going to give names too. So I've got Paul McCartney, Jackson Pollock. Let's see, who else do I got? I got Harrison Ford. I've got Jim Carrey. And I'm just using modern examples. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, what's another form of art? I'm trying to think. I got the guy who does the Blacklight Theater show in Prague, okay. Who none of us know, but his name is, you know, Pavel. I don't know, but that's what he does. So I get those, and he's really happy to meet Paul McCartney and the ghost, apparently, of Jackson Pollock. So, but anyway, somehow I've managed to get all these people in a room together. Well, you might look at them and you might say, hey, that Jim Carrey guy, he seems like a trickster. Because he, you know, except when he's trying to act in serious films, basically right. His shtick is comedy. He's a trickster. That Paul McCartney guy, well, he's a musician. He's kind of funny, too, when he you know, he has a bit of a sense of humor. But that he's a serious musician. Harrison Ford, he's a serious actor. Whatever. So Carrey would stand out as the trickster. But that doesn't mean, I mean, that he's different than the rest of them. They're all artists. They just apply their art in different ways. So when I hear people talk about the trickster, it's often in the believer camp where they say this is the answer, that it's a trickster playing with us, to which I would say, yes, every now and then we run into Jim Carrey. On the other hand, and I've been in situations, I talk about one in the book at a cemetery in England, well, it's not even a town, it's out in the middle of nowhere, but it's near a town called Shocklack, very old church and cemetery, where we had a series of strange events, literally, you know, bing, 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 happening to all of us at different times, caught none of it on camera, caught none of it on audio, nothing, but we all heard it, we saw it in different ways and shapes and forms. I would say that was our night at the Improv with Jim Carrey. There were other experiences that I had. The one I talk about, a shadow person, which I ran across in Český Krumlov, which is a town in the Czech Republic. After we had finished shooting Ghost Cases, Holly and I traveled to Europe for a couple weeks. Well, we were in Europe anyway. We were in England. And so we had an extended vacation. If you're there, why not? It's one of the great things about shooting a television show. If they're flying you to another place, you've already got the flight there paid for. So why don't you just stay and do some touring, which is what Holly and I did. Anyway, we wound up in this town in the very, very old town, the Czech Republic. I went for a walk one night, had a series of experiences with what I could only describe as a shadow person or a shadowy figure. Let's call the shadowy figure. Well, it wasn't Jim Carrey. That was more like hanging out with George Romero or... whoever made Rosemary's Baby, and this is terrible, I should know that, because it's one of my favorite horror films, William Friedkin, who wrote The Exorcist, whatever,
right.
One of these sort of creepy, M. Night Shyamalan, there you go, you'll appreciate it, one of these creepy sort of atmospheric, moody horror films, but I think it's the same actor or the same intelligence interacting with me in both cases, but one night, it's Jim Carrey. The next night, it's M. Night Shyamalan. But it's, you know, there's no difference. So that's why I don't like the term the trickster, because I think it focuses far too much on the Jim Carrey aspect. Whereas I think a lot of what the so-called trickster, that is to say the advanced non-human intelligence is doing, some of it is playful. Because playfulness inspires the imagination, absolutely, in certain ways, at certain times. But so does fear. Fear is one of the primal human emotions, and I think that's what the advanced non-human intelligence tries to do with us, to connect us at our primal emotional levels. Love, fear, laughter, joy, you know, all those sorts of things, even sadness sometimes. So, the trickster isn't a term I like using, but I understand where they're coming from, and I do believe that in some cases we run into the Jim Carrey version of the advanced non-human intelligence. Depends on which, you know, it's kind of, I'd like to say it's kind of like buying a ticket. If you and I want to go see a movie, we have to buy a ticket, right? So if we don't buy a ticket, we're not going to get in to see, unless we sneak in. But even then, you would have to make the effort to get into the theater. You have to somehow get in the theater. So if you don't actually go in the theater, you can't see the movie. Well, I think the paranormal is the same way. I think we can all experience the paranormal. I think the interaction is available there for all of us in different ways. But I think you have to open yourself to it. And to me, that's the equivalent of buying that ticket or sneaking into the theater. When you do that, you and I could go to the same multiplex theater. You might decide to go see the latest M. Night Shyamalan film for reasons that boggle my mind. And, you know, maybe I decide to go see the new Tom Cruise film, the Oblivion. Fine. So now we're in the same theater. We bought the same ticket from the same, well, not the same ticket, but we bought a ticket from the same person who's selling the tickets. And we're in the same theater, but then we go see different movies. Well, I think that's what the paranormal is, the theater run by the same management. But within that theater, there are many different movies. I'll see this. I love having conversations because I'm writing my next book even as we speak. And, you know, it continues to refine itself. There are many different movies. So you're watching M. Night Shyamalan. I'm watching a science fiction film or whatever. But we're all in the same theater. And so the tricksters and maybe another friend of ours bought a ticket to the new Adam Sandler film. So he's in laughing his head off as you're kind of being creeped out as I'm going, wowee, to this sci-fi epic. But we're all experiencing a feature film that is engaging us, except perhaps the M. Night Shyamalan film, in meaningful ways. Sorry, folks, anyone who didn't hear the pre-game chat between Siri and I would understand we were chatting about M. Night Shyamalan, who I write about in the book a bit.
Who you don't have the greatest love for, but who I absolutely love his stuff.
Yeah, I think he's a lousy one-trick filmmaker, but I do think when he made his one-trick film, The Sixth Sense, he made a really good film. It's just he hasn't, and he's got, anyway, that's a longer story. Yes. But, you know, that we're all in that movies theater and we're all watching different films, but the theater itself is the paranormal. So it would be a mistake to say, if you drove by the theater and say, oh, that's the Adam Sandler comedy theater. That's where you go see Adam Sandler films. Well, yes, there is an Adam Sandler film playing there, but there's also a Tom Cruise film playing. So there's all sorts of films playing within the paranormal. I just, very long-winded answer by way of saying the trickster, I don't like that term because I think that's akin to saying it's the Adam Sandler theater.
Right, right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's a good analogy for the whole thing. You're obviously like movies. There's no doubt there.
Well, yeah, it's part of, you know, it's kind of a job requirement that I actually have to like them in order to be able to make them.
True.
And even if I didn't like them, I'd have to be able to understand them in order to be able to make them.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the theories you put forth in the book was a novel theory, as far as I'm concerned. I've never really heard anyone suggest it before, is that this non-human intelligence could be time travelers, but not from our future, from our past.
Right.
And, I mean, time travelers in the future are a common theory thrown about. I don't think I've ever heard anyone suggest it might be from our deep past.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, there's a couple of things about that. First of all, by that point in the book, I'm just engaging in thought experimentation.
Right.
So, which I think is, you know, throw it all out there. A lot of people, my friend, the late Mac Tonies, wrote a book called The Crypto-Terrestrials about an advanced civilization we might be sharing the planet with. He was roundly criticized. It was published after his death. A lot of people liked it who understood what he was doing. But people who didn't understand what he was doing, particularly in the UFO community, roundly criticized him by saying, this is all crazy. This is nuts. And what he was doing, he was engaging in a thought experiment. And he was trying to stimulate people to think. And a lot of what he was writing in the book made sense, even if his overall theory, he didn't believe it either. He was just throwing it out there and using it as a prism through which he could make certain arguments and observations about it. That's fine. So that's kind of, I like those sorts of things. I think we should have more people doing more thought experiments, not less.
Absolutely.
So that's what my time travel thing was. But basically, you know, our planet is what? Billions of years old. Our recorded history is maybe a few thousand years. And even if you go back to the Roman times, and I really like ancient history. I read a lot of it. We know very little about the Roman Empire. we know bits and pieces, but there's large parts of our knowledge about Rome that we'll never know because the records are lost or whatever.
Right.
So that's only 2,000 years ago. We don't even really know everything that happened in the last century. Only now, once we've started recording things, video, radio, that sort of, can we keep a much more accurate record. And even that, there's stuff that maybe we know and maybe we don't, government records that are still secret, whatever. So that's our knowledge of our planet. You know, we know that the dinosaurs existed millions upon millions of years ago, but people say, well, what was the Jurassic period? And, believe, you know, if my science, I can't remember which period was which, but so I'm just going to spitball here. But say the Jurassic period was, you know, 100 million AD or BC, sorry, to 80 million BC, whatever. Right, that's 20 million years. You know, that's not like saying 20 hours ago.
Right.
So we have the, again, it's like the universe with this massive amounts of time. And then there's this entire period before even the dinosaurs where we just kind of shrug our shoulders and go, we don't know, you know, we have, like, who knows?
Yeah, there's big holes throughout our, right. our history.
To say there's, well, to say there's holes in our history, you know, our planet's history is a giant gaping hole.
Yes.
You know, way back in the distant past. So what I speculate in the book is, hey, what if a billion years ago, now I want folks to focus on that number, billion years ago. Think about how old you are and then think about a billion years. So what about a billion years ago, there was an advanced civilization that arose on this planet. We wouldn't know about it now. We wouldn't be able to find a trace of it. Anybody who tells me that we would be able to find their garbage doesn't know what they're talking about. They're ridiculous.
Well, that there, too, relies on a lot of assumptions that they were just like us, that they were just as consumer-based as we were, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I would assume that any civilization would have to begin the way we did, go through, you know, so at some point they would have to be at somewhere along the, like, our level of sophistication, and then they would continue to move on. So, you know, you don't just show up, I don't think, as a hyper-intelligent super-being species.
Right.
At the beginning. So a billion years ago, if we were looking at the right time, we could probably find the garbage. But that was a billion years ago. You know, it took us thousands of years to find Troy, which was considered a mythical civilization until very recently, by which I mean the last 100 years. So, you know, anyone who could tells me that if there was a civilization a billion years ago, we'd find it, a trace of it, is crazy. Conversely, I can't prove that there was. But remember, folks, this is a thought experiment. So anyway, my idea is that I just threw out there was, well, okay, what if the civilization advances over a period of a million years? So, for, you know, the first 2,000 years are kind of like our first 2,000 years. So imagine us 998,000 years from now, where we are. That's where they got in a million years. Now, remember, that million years within the multi-billion-year history of our planet is still just a drop in the bucket. They could have came, lived, their civilization grown, and then completely disappeared. But what if they become so advanced they master time travel? Well, time travel, I actually attended a lecture by Michio Kaku in London in 2009 where he said time travel is theoretically possible, and he writes about this in his books. And then he says it would actually be easier to travel forward in time than backwards. He was kind of unconvinced about the idea of ever being able to go backwards in time because the grandfather paradox that Carl Sagan wrote about, a whole bunch of things.
Right.
But he said going forwards in time, well, that's a different story. We already can do that in certain way. You know, when you get out into space and you actually travel forward in time as opposed to back. Long story. But anyway, he kind of put that bug in my mind and I sort of ran with it. Bug, what an odd way of putting it. He put that idea in my mind and I sort of ran with it. So they become so advanced they can master time travel and then they travel forward in time to see how their planet develops after they're gone. So, and what if they're doing it, again, thought experiment, the idea of traveling forward in time, they don't do it literally in terms of their corporeal bodies, but maybe they've advanced to a sort of that super hyper-intelligent consciousness, maybe even a collective consciousness. And so what they're doing is they're sending their ideas, they're sending their persona, if you will, forward in time. And that's what we're interacting with. So they're the advanced non-human intelligence from our distant past, our planet's different distant past, an entirely different species than us that we're interacting with here in the modern era. Do I think that's what's happening? No. But do I think it's a really cool science fiction idea? Yes.
It is a great science fiction idea.
Yes, a script coming in 2017 from me. But do I think it's possible? Yeah, I certainly think it's possible that there was a civilization on this planet before ours, millions or billions of years ago. I think that's possible. Whether it could have been like an alien civilization from another planet, could have come here, settled, colonized, and then died off or left, we'd have no trace of it. So I think those things are possible. Did they master time travel and travel forward in time? Are they traveling forward in time to say hello to us? I don't know about that. But it's an interesting speculation if you posit that there might have been a civilization here predating, ours, and also predating sort of recorded history, like millions and billions of years ago.
Right.
But we should be open to those kinds of speculation, if for no other reason than, like with my friend Mac's book, it allows us to start thinking about the concept of time travel and all these other things. And again, that idea of imagining something outside the day-to-day box of our own real existence, if you will.
There is an H.P. Lovecraft story. I think it was The Shadow Out of Time, where something in the distant past takes over a human in the present and switches places with them. Not quite the same thing, but it's along a similar line.
See, there you go. I've stolen from H.P. Lovecraft without even knowing it.
So. Not quite stolen, because it wasn't a paranormal sort of thing. They swap bodies.
Yeah, and definitely not stolen. If the estate of H.P. Lovecraft is listening right now, absolutely. This is like George Harrison with My Sweet Lord. I had no idea. I've never read H.P. Lovecraft. All hail Cthulhu, though. Just wanted to get that in to be safe.
There was something else. We're almost out of time for tonight, but there was one other thing I wanted to get to with you. Oh, the observer effect you were talking about. And this is a little different from the idea of the observer effect in quantum physics. You were talking about this on sort of a macro level.
Right. Any filmmaker, any documentary filmmaker knows immediately what the observer effect is, because as soon as you point a camera at someone, their behavior will change. So unless you're using hidden cameras and they have no idea that you're there, every documentary to some point, some degree or another, is staged. Because you're not getting a completely accurate representation of the behavior of the people. So so when you observe something, and I use the example of documentary filmmaking because that's where I come from, but it works in many other ways. If you know, for instance, that the police cameras, it's why we put police cameras up on streets, far too many in my mind, but that's why they're there to modify behavior. So the theory being that if you know you're being watched, you're less likely to urinate on the side of the road outside the bar, or to beat some guy, or whatever criminal activity you might be engaged in, or antisocial activity. So it's this idea that when you're observed, our behavior changes. And the trick is, and I talk about this, an example of a best friend of mine who used to be able to just look at girls in bars. I could never master this talent myself, because I'd always look away, but he would stare them down and he could lure them over to our table. We actually had a bet once where he did. He said he could get that. See that cute girl over there? I can get her and her friend at our table within the next 10 minutes. Bet you a pitcher of beer. 7 minutes later, I was buying him a pitcher of beer and I was buying drinks for the two girls at our table. He didn't wave at them. He didn't, anything. He just stared at them in that certain way of his. And they, by being observed, it changed their behavior. So that's controlling the behavior. And that's an interesting, he literally sort of hypnotized them into coming over to us. And that was a really cool night, too, now that I think about it. Anywho, I digress. So this idea that if there is an advance in non-human intelligence, and if it's making us aware that it's observing us, does that change our behavior? And I think it does. I think, and especially God is the perfect example, the very concept of God, even if we created it ourselves, is designed as a tool of social control, certainly as the churches have used it. And I mean churches in all religious faiths have used it throughout human history. It is a tool of social control. Now, even if you strip all that away, if you're standing out in a field by yourself and you feel like, well, this is a PG-rated show, so let's just imagine the worst possible thing you could do in a field by yourself in a sexual nature, folks. And if you stop to think about it, And there's a sheep wanders by. Fine, there we go. And you stop to think, oh, laddie, wait now. Maybe there's a supernatural being watching me. Perhaps I shouldn't be doing that. I might go to hell. You know, that's my worst possible Irish accent. So if my friends in Ireland are somehow listening to this, I apologize. But that's what the observer effect is. If you feel like you're being watched, it can change your behavior. And I think that's an aspect of the paranormal too. Although I use that as a launching point to talk about the human condition. If the advanced non-human intelligence is looking at us, what does it see? And if nothing else, that's a useful conversation to have because it forces us to look at ourselves and who we are. And that's an entirely other show, folks, because that's a long chapter. But that's what the observer effect is.
Rupert Sheldrake actually deals with that at some length as well on some of his studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not crazy paranormalism. That's real science, but it's also real life in the sense that certainly somebody like me does that, but we deal with it all the time. Like I said, if you've got police cameras on the streets, they are changing your behavior. Even somebody looking and watching you changes your behavior. So, that's something that we can all experience on a day-to-day basis. The question is, if there is something, an advanced non-human intelligence, is it doing the same thing to us? And then is it just a passive observation, or is it actually trying to change our behavior, our way of thinking, through the observer effect? And that's slightly different.
All right. You're on WVBR FM Ithaca. This is Where Did the Road Go? And we've been talking for the last hour with Paul Kimball, author of The Other Side of Truth. And it's subtitled The Paranormal, The Art of Imagination, and The Human Condition. Where can people get this book, Paul?
It's available on Amazon. It's out in Kindle ebook format now. We have a publishing deal. My company has a publishing deal. I publish a lot of books with a European publisher. So it's available in ebook format. Or the easiest place to find everything that I've done is to go to my company's website, where you can see most of my films for free if you want, because our distributors have them available online. It's at www.redstarfilmtv.com. And you can link to it through the Where Did the Road Go website, because you kindly put it up there as well.
That we did. And is this your only book?
Yeah, it's the only one I've ever written, although I am working on a sequel. And we have books by Nick Redfern, Aaron Gullius. You know, my company's publishing a lot of books, not all of them paranormal related, but a lot of them are. So at the company's website, you can find books either published currently or coming up by other authors. So keep an eye out for those too.
Okay. And as far as your filmmaking, you're currently working on you said it was a psychological thriller?
Yes, supernatural psychological thriller. We shot it. I've just finished the cut. So it's going off to the post audio. The composer's working on it in England. Should be out, hopefully. You know, this is me knocking on my wooden desk. Should be out sometime this summer, the fall at the latest. And I'm in finishing up a script and sort of entering pre-production for my next one, again, which has a supernatural sort of science fiction theme. So these are ideas, these are concepts that I like to explore, you know, in my work as well. I think that's one of the great things about fiction. And it's my criticism of M. Night Shyamalan aside, he's tried to explore, maybe you think more successfully than I have, but at least he's engaging these kinds of ideas. And again, that's a good example of what artists do. They talk about, the good ones talk about these big picture ideas and try and get people to think about them, even as they entertain them.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. And your documentaries are up on your site as well. You did the one on Stanton Friedman. What else have you done?
You can find a documentary on Stan Friedman. There's one called Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Sightings, one on cattle mutilations, which I think can all be explained, but people can watch and judge for themselves. And a couple episodes of the Ghost series are up. The two that I like the best, the two most interesting ones to me, are available on the site as well. So even if you're not in Albania, Iran, or Thailand, you know, if you're in Romania, you can see them too.
Is there anywhere anyone can see the rest of those ghost cases?
Not unless you're in Albania, Iran, or Thailand, because it's not airing in Canada anymore. And it's the one project I've done where I don't own the rights. So the production company that does and the distributor, they haven't released it on DVD. So I don't know if they're going to or not. That's out of my hands. But you can see two episodes at my website. And if you're in Albania, you can see the whole thing.
All right. Well, I thank you, Paul. Is there anything else that you have coming up that people should know about?
No. I think we've just about covered. I'm terrible at plugging myself. I hate doing it. So I think we've just about covered it. You know, people can check in at the company's website every now and then, though, if they want to. You know, there's always updates posted if new things do come up. That's where you'd see them first.
All right. Excellent. You're on Twitter, Facebook?
I am. Actually, The Other Side of Truth has a Facebook page. I am on Facebook. And, yeah, I'm on Twitter, too. It's at Red Star Films, I think. But I'm easy enough to find. If you sort of Google my name, my Facebook and Twitter feeds will show up as well.
Okay. And you don't own a cell phone, do you?
No, I hate them. I'm the only film producer, director in the world, I think, that doesn't have one. I like my Walden moments. I like being able to disconnect. So, yeah, no, I hate cell phones. I recognize they're useful, but I hate them.
I used to feel that way, but it got to a point where I couldn't live without it. Still don't like them.
My dream in life is to someday retire to a distant cottage in the highlands of Scotland and not even have a computer or the internet and just sort of front the world, you know, kind of by myself, honestly. Until then, I do have the internet, I do have a computer, but I will draw the line at a cell phone.
All That's right. Where I draw the line. And to close this interview off, we're going to hear a song from one of your... How many bands were you in back in the 90s?
I was in two in the Halifax Pop Explosion. I was in the 90s. I was in one called Tall Poppies, and I guess the song you're going to hear is from my second one, as a band called Julia's Rain. We released a couple albums and actually turned a record deal down once, which is another interview. But yeah, you know, it's time traveling back to my own past.
All right,
so this from 1995.
And this is called what?
Louder Than Bombs, which is a good song to listen to after the past week because it's all about the thing that's most important, which is love.
All right. And one more time, your website?
www.redstarfilmtv.com.
All right. Thank you much, Paul.